guys start tape now? Should I start tape too?
Thanks very much. I lost my voice at the Reggae Festival, as all of you know. Those who are now watching over the Global Broadcast Network may not know that I lost most of my voice at the Reggae Festival. But I want to welcome you to a new tradition here at the World Debate Institute. It seemed like if we all got together at once, we might as well take an opportunity to explore new ideas and new possibilities and develop new themes, and also to have a lecture where there was no assigned topic, to ask some distinguished person from the debate community to give that address so that we could all benefit from it. We'll be recording it to have it available on the internet. We'll also be transcribing it. And I have very little idea of what the content of this lecture is, which is why I'll be listening to it with rapt attention, and I hope you'll join me in that. The keynote address of the 1999 World Debate Institute will be delivered by Jim Wade. Jim Wade is a teacher and debate coach at Milton High School in Georgia, where he's been now for some 19 years. He's the kind of English teacher who assigns you to read a book like Something Wicked This Way Comes by Ray Bradbury. Since 1980, he's been the debate coach there, and he's had a very illustrious and successful string of successes through the years. He's also been lucky enough to successfully coach two of his children as they debated, which is a delightful thing to do. I urge you to try that, to get your children to debate. And you'll enjoy it as a parent as well. One year at the Emory Debate Institute, Melissa said, you know, we got these students who want to come for Lincoln Douglas debate, and we really need an adult to be able to be responsible for the students in the Lincoln Douglas Debate Institute. Will you do it? And then he said yes, and that meant he had to figure out what Lincoln Douglas debate was all about. Instead of doing that, Jim Wade went about redefining what Lincoln Douglas debate is, to make it an extremely intellectual and sophisticated activity to discuss a wide variety of themes as well as assist students in research. And he's now probably the leading purveyor of Lincoln Douglas debate curriculum in the United States. He loves used CD stores. I'm told that if he has a few cashews and a Coke, he's satisfied with whatever situation. He believes that the greatest baseball franchise of all time is the Atlanta Braves. After 34 years of teaching and coaching, he has a few words for us. Please welcome, and the title of his address is Michael Can Hit. Jim Wade.
At the Emory Debate Workshop in June, Tuna asked me to give this talk. I volunteered to do something. I wasn't expecting this. And when he told me I could talk about anything, I really had no idea what to even say. And so I didn't say yes to him. I said, well, I'll think about it and I'll get back to you. And what I usually do when I have a decision to make, I decided not to think about it for a few minutes. And so I went to another store I like, a used bookstore, to find it was really sort of a bargain bookstore, just to look around and let my muse come to me and see what I found. Well, I went to a room in this bookstore that is new books. They're all 75% off, and that may give you some kind of clue as to what kind of books they are. One book I saw was The Lost History of the Canine Race. And I sort of cocked my head at that one, but I didn't even pick that up. Another one I saw was circumcision exposed. I thought I didn't want to go there at all, but I didn't want to do that. But I did see a book called Sociological Reality, A Brief Introduction. Okay, well, that deserved picking up. And so I looked at it, and in the introduction it said, reality is out there for anyone to experience and interpret. Well, that sort of sounded like maybe I should be doing something. Certainly, I think I see reality, and that I absolutely interpret it all the time. So maybe that was positive. And then I saw a book that I actually ended up buying. It was, you know, inside, I saw the title. And the title was Why Michael Couldn't Hit. Well, I'm thinking education, high school topic. I thought, you know, why Michael can't read. Oh, well, education, I picked it up. And it's Michael Jordan on the cover, baseball player, swinging a bat. And this was a neurologist writing about humans and human development and looking at the lives of athletes and focusing, at least initially, on Michael Jordan. When I pulled it out, it told an intriguing story. In 1994, Michael Jordan played baseball. He retired from basketball after three consecutive NBA championships. He had been the leading scorer 3 years, and he said, well, gosh, you know, I just can't be any better. I think I'll try baseball. And so he started playing with the Chicago White Sox farm team in Double-A baseball in Birmingham with the Birmingham Barons. At the end of that year, he had one outstanding feature. He had the lowest batting average in the league. He batted .202. Every 100 at-bats, he got 20 hits. Now, in those same 100 at-bats, he also struck out 28 times. He didn't distinguish himself, and of course, the rest is history. He came back to basketball, and he's still doing great things. It seemed like it was too late for him to pick up on baseball. The author of that book, Harold Kawan, said, productivity in math, physics, and poetry peaks in the late 20s. Novelists, philosophers, and historians peak in the late 40s and early 50s. Hey, well, I'm an English teacher. That's sort of like a philosopher in my mind. And I thought, well, yeah, you know, gosh, whoa, wait, I guess I am sort of peaking now. I'm 49. I'm a better teacher than I've ever been. I at least understand it more. I feel like I know what's going on. Maybe I do have some things to say. And I decided then, sure, hey, what the heck, turn up, yeah, I'll do this. This is a very weird audience. High school students, college students, coaches who aren't coaches yet, teachers, coaches who are coaches, coaches here as teachers here as coaches. It's just a very weird mix. And I was somewhat daunted by that, and then I thought, geez, well, it's one of those things that's so obvious it doesn't hit you. I guess really we're all students and teachers. We're all both learning and being taught, and so maybe we are all one audience, in fact. As a teacher, I find that every new year is a challenge, every new class is a challenge. I enjoy the changes in curriculum, I enjoy teaching new subjects because it demands that I rethink what I want to do. But even classes I've taught before demand rethinking, and something I think debate has taught me is that there's always more out there to do, more out there to notice, more out there to think. And so I'm constantly challenged to think of new things to do. And it always seems like I can do things better. If I think about it a little more, there's even something better that I haven't really thought about yet. And so I guess that's what this is sort of trying to do, is maybe give a wake-up call. Now, something I try with classes all the time, I have a lot of things, and I get mixed reviews of something, so I decided I talked to someone about, well, maybe we'll try it here. This is probably the most intellectually capable audience I'll ever have. See, I'm a teacher, I'm not a speaker. And so I thought, you know, I tell these jokes sometimes and they don't go over with most classes. And I thought, well, maybe it's me. Maybe they're not funny. Maybe it's just the audience. And so I want to share just a minute or two, not even two, a couple of lines from my favorite comedian, I think, or at least the favorite comedian that I know, Stephen Wright. Yeah, okay, you know Stephen Wright, obviously. I have the world's largest collection of seashells. I keep it on beaches all over the world. Perhaps you've seen it. I went to a restaurant that serves breakfast at any time, so I ordered French toast during the Renaissance. I saw a subliminal advertising executive, but only for a second. On the other hand, you have different fingers. I'm writing an unauthorized autobiography. My school colors were clear. We used to say, I'm not naked, I'm in the band. You vindicated me. Sometimes my high school students just don't get it. Okay, but that's good. Now that I've got your attention, I would encourage you to be the best students and teachers that you can be. Everything else will fall into place. You don't really have to worry about anything if you're trying to learn and trying to teach. It's funny, little things, little irritations, little distractions keep getting in our way. And I don't know how to really get around that except to let it roll off your back. Tuna said, would you like to give this address? I said, oh, sure. And so now for a few minutes, you are my students. I'm reminded of a cow sitting cross-legged on a hill in my favorite Far Side cartoon. And he's sitting there speaking to some other cows, this guru of a cow, and he looks at them and says, never forget as you go through life to stop and eat the roses. Well, I'm not an expert on the world and I don't have great advice like that, but I do see the world from my particular hill and I can share that with you today. There are a few things I wanted to talk about. And the first of those is that I think that they help students, and of course I think we all agree with that because we're here. An independent evaluator of the New York Urban Debate League program wrote recently, debate activities have a powerful impact on adolescents' emotional and social development. Students report feeling higher self-esteem, an increased capacity to speak out, and a greater sense of determination and perseverance as a result of their debate experience. Students also identify feeling more able to develop and/or strengthen relationships with peers and adults, and an increased ability to communicate well with others. Debaters enjoy feeling like they belong to a valued group, the big debate family. Now, her observations match my experience. I wasn't surprised at what she said, and yet in many ways I was radically surprised because it surprised me that an outsider would understand that and be able to say it so effectively. I think she's describing what I would call a real high school or college debate team, or she's describing an effective lab group at a workshop like this. And the one thing that she says that catches me most that I hadn't really thought about until I thought about what she said and I looked at what she said is that she wasn't trying to say this happened. She was saying that students think this happened. And I thought, you know, that's really what it's all about. If you think you can communicate more, you communicate more. If you think your communication is more effective, then sure enough, it will be more effective because you take that into the efforts that you take. And so it just seems like debate is doing something. Now, we certainly have a family, a very freaky family, and Uncle Tuna up there is the freakiest, perhaps, member of the ball. But we enjoy our company. Edith Hamilton said, to be able to be caught up into a world of thought, that is educated. And think about what's going on here. We have created in this environment a world of thought, and we are offering it to students to bring them in. It's not so much what's learned, but to engage in a process where the currency is thought and interaction and communication. There's something very powerful in the education that occurs and that develops here. I'm an idea person. Most of us here, I'm sure, are idea people. I know what happens when you focus and when you concentrate. There's a stunted comedian named Jeff Foxworthy who said, you know you're a redneck if you stare at the orange juice can because it says concentrate. Well, most of us know what it's like to concentrate. We know what it's like to uncover new ideas and deal with complex ideas. There's something very special. Debate taught me that. There's no question at all. Debate led me into a world that I could not have imagined growing up. Donna Bokate of the University of Colorado wrote a book called Intrapersonal Communication, Different Voices, Different Minds. In it, she says that it is in society, and more particularly in the verbal intercourse called conversation, that people have acquired what the most intelligent other minds have never developed, intellect. We have a supercharged environment here. We have people on intellectual overdrive, and you can feel the pilot. Those of you that haven't been to a workshop before, give yourself a day or two, and it'll freak you out how you can literally feel the energy and the excitement, the consciousness and the awareness that's being shared. I don't know whether it's God, whether it's nature, what happens, but something allows us to be conscious and to develop our intellect. We can challenge it. We can focus it. We can develop it. We can nurture it and allow it to grow. We can polish it if it's dull and underused. That's not a great analogy, but analogies are something special. A good metaphor is very nice. Being an English teacher and thinking about that, a few months ago I got an email that indicated some metaphors that I've had fun using in class. McBride fell 12 stories hitting the pavement like a hefty bag filled with vegetable soup. He was as tall as a 6'3" tree, long separated by cruel fate. The star-crossed lovers raced across the grassy field toward each other like two freight trains, one having left Cleveland at 6:36 p.m. traveling at 35 miles per hour. John and Mary had never met. They were like two hummingbirds who had also never met. The little boat gently drifted across the pond exactly the way a bowling ball wouldn't. And my favorite, her eyes glistened in the rain like nose hair after a sneeze. I like metaphors, and I'm constantly, you kids said, oh, you're Mr. Analogy, because I'm always looking for that. And I thought about metaphors, and I thought, I don't have a metaphor for debate. Oh, I've got little comparisons and little analogies that hit on elements of debate, but I don't think there is a parallel to what's happening over the next couple of weeks and what's been happening in all of our lives. The growing self-awareness and self-confidence just happens. You don't seek it, it just happens. The second thing I want to raise for your consideration is that I believe debate creates a community, a big debate family. You've crossed a bridge into a workshop. You've left friends, and you've left jobs, and you've left parents, and you've left a world out there, and you've come here to grow and to share and to deal with ideas. The foundations of our intellects are being solidified and developed, and the horizons are being blown away. And when you go back, the world won't really have changed very much, but it'll have changed a lot because you will have changed when you go back into that world. Before you came into this room, you were outside, and you've been here before, most of you, but you didn't know who was going to be sitting where, you didn't know where you would be sitting, you didn't know what it would be. A world sort of became created when we walked in. When my daughter was growing up, there was a book that I read with her often, and it was a very neat book called Grover and the Everything in the Whole Wide World Museum. We got some devotees. And it's sort of a vocabulary book. You go to a museum, and there's a museum of things under the sea, and a museum of colors, and so there are all these pictures, and you can go with the child and say, oh, this and this, and you name names. And as Grover goes through the pages, through the different rooms, he comes to the end, to a door, and over the door it says, everything else in the whole wide world. And he opens the door and he realizes that's the door to outside, because everything else in the whole wide world is just outside those doors. And it's outside your car or your plane or your bus or whenever you go back home. You will be moving out to the rest of the world. But what you take out will be something more than what you came in with. We are creating an environment. It's a funny thing. We're not used to changes. We see things change so very slowly, and some things that seem so very important don't seem to be changeable at all. And yet I think life does change. we're sort of in a weightless environment here. We've left the inertia of our old lives, and we've come into a room, and there's some people who've already been here, even before you got here a few days ago, those of you on the staff, who began the ball rolling in this environment. And we're here to pick it up or keep it rolling and keep it moving. Historian James Harvey Robinson wrote, "The chief strength of the ancient Greeks lay in their freedom from hampering intellectual tradition. They had no venerated classics, no holy books, no dead languages to master, no authorities to check their free speculation." I think we're sharing that kind of environment. Debate will not be confined to the past. Every new topic raises new issues and demands that we re-examine the issues of the past to do more than what's been done with those issues before, to rethink the old with almost complete freedom. Now, I don't want to be too anthropocentric, and so I look to nature for examples that I might be able to use here. Several weeks ago, I was at the Emory Library, in part thinking about this, in part thinking about my classes coming up in the fall, and I found a book called Degrees of Freedom, Living in Dynamic Boundaries, by a biologist named Alan Rayner. Well, the title sort of got my attention, and so I looked at this, and it caught my eye on the shelf. I was flipping through the book in the debate style, and I found something interesting. He said that through a process of self-fusion, fungi have nuclear civil wars. Oh, my eyes have nuclear war. See, nuclear war jumps off the page to me. Nuclear war, okay, it's like, you don't have to highlight it, I can see it. And a nuclear, I mean, I haven't seen three good nuclear survival cards in my whole life, so he got my attention. Well, I looked through more. The pictures were weird because it's a science book and it's got all kind of weird stuff and diagrams and things. But then I saw something, a line that seemed to be pretty good advice that I would just share with you as a public service being here at the workshop. He said, mating in Bathydiomyces involves overriding the rejection response. Even fungi seem to have a hard time getting a date, I guess. Okay. So watch the rejection response, and if you can overcome that, you're okay. But in his introduction, he writes this. "Some of the examples I will use arise from my personal experience of working with fungi. The fungi are an entire kingdom of organisms. Yet the fundamental relevance of fungi to understanding how life forms emerge and change appears to have been strongly neglected." Well, obviously, we had to do something about that. Tuna's given me a chance to restore the fungi to their rightful place in the world. See, Professor Rayner argued that human systems are similar to fungi. Fungi develop in indeterminate, open-ended systems. And he argues that it's very dangerous to think of life as composed of discrete, predictably interacting units. Like fungi, human systems change and grow. They can change, and they can be changed. I believe that debate is indeterminate and dynamic. But we have a little bit smaller environment, so our potential to allow that and to encourage, to promote the change within that environment, I think, is even greater. But it's up to us. Debate will be what we make it. Debate is what we make it. The third thing I wanted to raise for your consideration is that I believe competition can cause the wrong kind of changes. Debate is intense intellectual competition. Now, some people need to win to prove themselves. You sort of prove something to other people when you succeed, and you prove that you're worthwhile, and you gain confidence. But I think people who walk in with confidence don't need to win nearly so much. The only real value of winning is that you didn't lose, and so you don't have to worry about what went on. I think we fear often that people will judge us if we fail or judge us if our teams fail. But the more emphasis we place on winning, the more damaging not winning becomes. We want to save face, but anybody who's been around debate very long realizes that the teaching that you do and the learning that goes on lasts long after the memories of wins and losses have died. Our educational system is filled with competition, competition for grades, competition for attention, competition for the favor of teachers and peers. I don't think debate's special because it's competitive. It's just another competitive thing. I think what really makes debate special is that there are coaches and there are people around to temper that competition, that can build that competition, that realize that competition is the tool, not the result. And it's something that we can do, those of you on staff and those of you that are simply college debaters, who will have opportunities as you move through your college career and after to perhaps become teachers of debate, if you're not already doing that. Because you see, you can encourage and allow students to move past that competition. Sports psychologist Thomas Tolko said, competition is a learned phenomenon. People are not born with a motivation to win or a desire to be competitive. People in our society see competition as very normal. It's sort of rooted in the survival of the fittest, right? If you're fit, you survive, you succeed, you beat out other people. But that, I don't know that that's right, and I've read some pretty interesting things that point to that as being wrong. Scientist Stephen Jay Gould says that survival actually usually depends on cooperation, not competition. And he says that the equation of competition with success and natural selection is merely a cultural prejudice. Now, competition has already been learned by every student you'll ever run across. We, in fact, are all experts at competition. Our job here is to harness it and to use it and to keep in mind what it can do, but never let it become the purpose of our efforts. The great danger of competition is that it is self-fulfilling and self-perpetuating. If we think the world is competitive, we become competitive to face it. We turn other people into our competitors. And psychologists say that when you take a competitive person and put them into a non-competitive environment, they lose a lot of that competitive edge. But if you take a non-competitive person and put them into a competitive environment, they do, in fact, become more competitive. The studies I read were talking about how people change their driving patterns as they move from one area of the country. But I think it's true overall. My experiences support that. When we deal with ideas like self-fulfilling prophecies and perpetuating our images of the world, I ran into something. You guys have been talking on the internet about rogue states and the kinds of language that occurs that we label when we label people, when we decide to treat people based on our assumptions about them. Last year, I was looking for some new poems just to feed into a class that was a little stale and needed some new stuff. And I ran into a poem by Kunwar Narayan called Preparations for War. I wanted to share that with you. After thousands of years, like the same beaten-up question, the same beaten-up man is still being asked, who are you? Where do you live? What's your name? The prisoner who patrols a motionless octagonal cell holds three guards captive at the same time. Everywhere outside, a forest of iron bars has spread its stranglehold like a magnet's invisible lines of force. And this is the solid proof of the success of a massive buildup of arms, that as soon as we had a gun in our hands, enemy heads began to appear all around us. The more you treat other people as your enemies, the more enemies you will have. Debate fires egos. Debaters, and as a high school teacher, teachers are always, my debaters are arrogant, they're obnoxious, they're opinionated, they're inflexible, they're egocentric and cynical, and they cause problems. Unfortunately, I think too often, the coaches model the students' behavior rather than serving as the models for their students to realize that other things might matter. We all know that non-winners debate still win because they too are changed. We can help people enjoy the process and not the trophy. My philosophy of debate has always been debate isn't fair. I tell students all the time, hey, if you've got to win every debate you win, just quit now. If you want every trophy you should win by rights, well, quit because it isn't going to happen. You're just going to eat yourself up inside. But overall, winning takes care of itself. You keep trying, you keep plugging through, you keep working at it, And the kinds of rewards you're looking for will come to you. But I really think debate can transcend that competition. Alfie Cohn wrote a book called No Contest. And in it, he actually refers specifically to academic debate three or four times, although it's a book, generally speaking, about competition. He says, debate is as consuming and in its own way as brutal as football. And I sort of felt tougher even as I'm reading it. But what's funny is he offers an alternative to debate. And what he says is, what we want are group activities with common goals and shared ideas, with divided labor and shared success. And I said, Alfie, you're talking about a debate team. You're talking about a laughter. You're talking about people who are working together in a very, very positive way. I do think debate can transcend that competition. Robert Beller wrote a book called Habits of the Heart. In it, he said, the world of individualistic competition is experienced every day. The world of harmonious unanimity is fully realized only in sporadic flashes of togetherness. It's a crazy kind of paradox that competition is what's normal. We think debate, oh, it's so weird. No, competition is very normal. But when we get that unity, when we get that cooperation, that working together, that's what's special. And that's what I think debate can offer us. At Emory, we heard about this one particular school in America that pays its students to debate. They pay high school students. They got a grant that's funded, it's not paid by public funds, it's a grant. See, they can't imagine the students would do this kind of work for fun, for free. And so they pay them. And I expect they get debaters who do the work they're assigned, and if they're asked to do more, ask for overtime. I don't know what kind of students actually come out of that program, and maybe that's a good incentive. But we know that that's not necessary. We laughed, it became sort of a joke among the workshop staff about paying students. But the funny thing is that even as we realize how ridiculous that is, I'm not sure we're all that different because we pay students in wins and in trophies. And it seems laughable to us to think that people would try if it wasn't for a win, that they would really try if it wasn't for a trophy. And yet, I don't know, debate's really good at talking critique, but I don't think it's very good at critiquing itself. I run the Lincoln Douglas workshop at Emory. And I'm a pretty flexible, laid-back kind of guy, and the staff always picks the topic we're going to debate because they're doing most of the real tight working with the students. And I'm very open on the rules, and we talk and we work out those rules. But this year I said, okay, guys, this is what I want to do now. I'm willing to hear your arguments about why we shouldn't, but you're going to have to convince me that I'm wrong, in which case I'll change. And what I said was, we'll have no decisions at the end of the workshop tournament. So we had a tournament, two-day tournament. There were no decisions. It was amazing. It was a great tournament. It was relaxed. It was fun. There were wonderful critiques and good conversation that went on. It was very, very positive, and we will always do that in the future. And it was neat because, you see, you could debate the best debater there, and you didn't worry about whether you lost or whether you won. You just tried to debate your best. And, of course, you all know that when you're debating someone good, usually your points are better because you debate up to them. You don't debate, it's a hard thing to debate really, really well against somebody who doesn't give you good arguments to respond to. Debate will become what we tell our kids it is. What we model in debate is what debate is. I don't know. There's a lot of things I've done for years without really thinking about it, and it just seemed like the right thing to say. And as I was putting this together, and it was I thank Jenna for asking me to do this because it caused me to think a lot about debate and a lot about what I think. But something that I've always told my students who are going to their first tournament, I tell them, I don't expect you to win. If you win a trophy, you are lucky. You hit people you could beat. That's great. You've got judges and thought you won. That's fabulous. That's wonderful. I don't expect you to win. You have one goal in your first tournament. Be ready for the second. Figure out what it takes. See what it's like. And what it does is I think that doesn't mean kids aren't competitive and they don't want to try to win, but it allows them to see something more than whether they walk away with the trophy at the end. And another thing I always try to do, and I certainly do with anybody who doesn't win a trophy, is at the end of a tournament, someone's first tournament, I always make a point to speak to people individually and ask a debater, how would you like to debate that first debate over again? And they smile and their eyes light up and say, oh, I'd kill them! Because they know how much they've learned just at one tournament. It doesn't take a lot to realize you're growing. But sometimes it does take a lot to realize you should notice that you're growing and that you're learning. An interesting thing happened to me this year. I'm not a terribly competitive person. About as little as most I think are going to, at least that's my self-perception, which may or may not be right. But I had an interesting experience this year at our state tournament. Georgia has a big high school debate community, but the state tournament is still archaic. It's run by the football coaches, and so long ago, the state tournament is set up as a four-person tournament. You take an affirmative team and a negative team. And so they debate round robin, and so there's 16 debates. And at this tournament, well, we had a good chance of winning. I had a new principal. My old principal made jokes about, gosh, I'm going to have to get a new trophy case. My new principal makes jokes like, gosh, you're spending a lot of money. That's not comforting kind of joke. Just smile. I'd rather have you smile than say stuff like that. So I thought, well, it'd be a good year to win. And there was one team that probably was the favorite. At least they had two debaters of their four that were more solid. And so, well, that's we're going to try to win. When the tournament was over, we had beaten that team both times. Both the affirmative and negative beat them. We ended up 14-2. They ended up 14-2. So we tied. They went to adjusted speaker points. Dropping high low, we tied again. They went to total speaker points, and we lost 5 points. So we were stuck. So we go down and we get our trophy, and that's too bad. And so I say, oh, that's okay, guys. I'm really proud of you and everything. And so I'm pretending like I wasn't disappointed at all, and they're doing pretty well. And we got the ballots back, and there was one particular round that they won, but they got really low points. And I saw the ballot, and I saw the judge, and I thought of the situation and the team they were against. And I was very suspicious of the motives and what was involved there, and I was sort of upset. And I'm still trying to act cool and nice and everything. And so we go back to the van, and I'm sort of bummed, but my kids are happy. They know they did well. They know they beat that team both times they debated them. Oh, I know some screwy things happened, but they felt good. And they were joking, and they were laughing, and talking about where to stop. And I realized, well, what the hell am I doing being upset? They're not upset. They know what's going on. And they sort of taught me something very important then. I knew it, but for a moment I forgot it. And I think that's the situation that most of us run into. Tuna, one thing he said, talk about whatever you want, but one thing he mentioned was, well, you know, what do you see about the future of the debate? What kind of vision might you have? And certainly that's one of the things I would like to see, is ways that we could develop a less competitive environment that encourage cooperation. And one thing I know can happen is, and what we've done in the Atlanta area for a couple of years, is have a couple of practice tournaments. When there are tournaments around, we want to send novices, and in those tournaments we don't give decisions. But one time, actually the first time, we did give decisions, but what I said is, okay, we're not going to give normal trophies. I had some, I don't know where I got them, I had a few trophies, and I said, what we're going to do is we're going to give the top two teams from each school the trophy. And we aren't going to mention the records. We're not going to talk about points. We're just going to say, you know, these are the top two teams from Milton, these are the top two teams from this school. But then others, we just haven't given decisions at all. And you know what? Those kids tried, they worked, and they learned, and I think they were more capable. And I know we can do that if we look for chances to do that. A second thing I think can happen in debate is that I think we can make schedules less intense and less oppressive. 3 or 4 years, I've been hosting a tournament a long time. Georgia tournaments usually are Friday, Saturday. We have 3 rounds on Friday, usually getting out between 11 and 1 o'clock on a Friday night. And I said, well, forget that. That's stupid. And so we just eliminated the third round on Friday. 2 rounds on Friday, get out at 9:30. Go eat, go back to the hotel. Watch something on TV. You know, be able to relax a little. And you know what? I cut out octo finals. So everybody debates five rounds. The octo-finalist and the 17th, always perpetual loser, gets a trophy too. Okay, so 8 through 17 get trophies. 18 don't debate. An entire tournament goes home and has a chance to relax and be human for a little while. And I don't think that's a bad price to pay, personally. A third thing I think can happen is that we can try to have more fun at tournaments. I know you try to create your own fun, but it was funny this year, a student said to me before the tournament, said, Mr. Wade, why don't we have a band play at the tournament? You know, like in a power match break. And I said, what a great idea. That never occurred to me before. And so I talked to some kids at the school. They have a rock band during Saturday, 11 to 12:30, power match break, lunch. Got a band in there playing loud music. Oh, three or four people left. 8 or 10 people came in. You know, 150 people are sitting there talking, joking, laughing, hunching over to talk to each other, getting more, you know, in a real, it was very, very deep. And I would never have a tournament without that. We went to a tournament at Newburgh where they did laser tag before the first round and took people. And it was a blast, and the kids got to know each other, and they did other things too there. Critiques have raised the issue in my mind, reinvent the wheel. For 25 years of my teaching career, I believe in the idea, if you don't reinvent the wheel, build. Sounds good. But then, when you get into this postmodernism stuff, you say, wait, no, reinventing the wheel is a bad. Because you're not what you were 10 years ago, or 5 years ago, or even 2 years ago, or last year. Rethink it, and start over, and build over. The fourth thing I wanted to raise is a broad issue. Is to comment on the amazing opportunity we have here. In dealing with science fiction with classes, I ran into this thing that, I don't know, someone made up, it's simple enough. It's not hard to draw on the board. You draw a big X, and then a horizontal line at the midpoint of the X across. And basically that represents time. And the horizontal line, the X, the midpoint of that X is the present. We are here at this particular moment, sharing this particular time. And the past, well, an hour ago, we weren't too far apart. A week ago, we were pretty far apart. And 5 years ago, gosh, you know, the further back you go, the more distant our lives were. But we have come together at this point in time. And, of course, in 3 weeks, we'll be moving apart. Well, in an hour, we'll be moving apart. And we'll start moving beyond into our own futures. But those futures can change. Look at people who, from the Urban Debate League, end up learning what debate is, and then debating in college. It doesn't take Urban Debate League. It's any kid in any high school in America who catches on. And we can't control everything, but we can control a debate environment and open doors in that environment. What does it take to challenge the worldview of a human being? I don't know. But if I was going to design an environment, I would probably pull that person out of their old environment, away from their home, away from their parents, away from their friends and their school and their jobs, and put them into an environment that is stimulating, that is challenging, that is fun and entertaining. Well, I think we're building that here. Go back to Harold Tawans. He's that neurologist who wrote Why Michael Couldn't Hit. He talked about a window of opportunity for developing an intellectual or physical skill, and he said, there was no way Michael Jordan was going to become a baseball player. He might be the best basketball player who ever lived. But in his 30s, he wasn't going to pick up a bat and hit even a good minor league, even an average minor league pitcher. He wasn't going to be able to do it. It was too late. That door had already been closed. Well, folks, when you deal with high school and college students, you're dealing at a critical time when the intellects are forming, that views of the world are being shaped, and attitudes are being developed. These are the critical years of development. Vermont here, the World Debate Institute, is a star, clearly, along with the Emory National Debate Institute, and the institutes at Claremont, the institutes in Kansas City, and the institutes around America. It's happening all over. Maybe we can reach critical mass. I don't know, but I don't worry about that. I know that when you invite people to participate, they do, they think, they become involved. Okay, now this is just to you students here, high school and college students here. A couple of questions. How do you get holy water?
Out of a tree.
You boil the hell out of it. What lies at the bottom of the ocean and twitches? A nervous wreck. What's the difference between an oral thermometer and a rectal thermometer?
The taste.
What's the difference between roast beef and pea soup? Anyone can roast beef. Asking leads to engagement. Opening doors, inviting, leads to involvement. For you students who are here at the workshop, I encourage you to embrace the learning and build on what you know. Don't think you know anything. You don't know anything. But boy, your knowledge can allow you to learn a whole lot and learn it very quickly. Reconstruct your knowledge of debate. High school coaches, share the experience so you can shape the experience for your children, for your students. This is clearly a stepping stone. That UDL evaluation that I mentioned earlier, the writer also said this, coaching professionalism is the single most important factor influencing program quality. A successful school-based intervention requires a coach who can serve as a mentor, demonstrate respectful, kind, nurturing, and supportive attitudes toward his or her students. Hold students accountable to high standards. Be perceived by students as reliable and trustworthy. And encourage cooperative teaching and learning while also articulating clear objectives for student work. Coaches must also possess at least a minimal understanding of debate mechanics and topic content. Well, new coaches, you'll gain that minimum level of understanding and topic content. But even more than that, you'll get to watch a world created, a world developed all around you that you'll be able to work with in your high school. Without a coach, debate dies. The enthusiasm just filters back into the regular high school curriculum. Workshop staff, well, you're ultimately in your life, for some of you are teachers, a lot of you on the staff, some of you on the staff are still students yourselves. And those of you that are students, you're seeking jobs, and ultimately, I hope, seeking vocations, seeking a place where you can fit in the world, where you can matter, where your existence can actually mean something. Well, debate's a way to test out what it's like to work with people closely, to teach people and learn from people and share with people. One UDL coach talked to me after the Emory tournament at the end of the workshop. He said he saw this amazing critique. He said this college debater was talking to the kids, and he wasn't talking down to them. He was lifting them up. And many of us have had that experience when you realize that what debate is sharing, because you really want people to understand it every bit as well as you do, so they can own it and they can use those ideas too. Teaching is a great, great life, and I'm very, very glad that I backed into it sort of randomly and accidentally. I wouldn't change it for the world. Those of you here get to sort of see what it's like in a very wonderful setting, and maybe consider options that you hadn't considered before. In my classes, at least in some of my classes, I talk about heroes as a literary concept, and I have problems with heroes. The idea of heroes is so ingrained in our mind. We look at these grand conquerors and these dynamic, amazing feats of the heroes. And so I really try to get past that very, very quickly, to not talk about heroes, but to talk about the heroic act. See, grand heroes are very few, I think, and they're very distant from most of our lives. Most of us won't be called to be heroes and to truly give up our lives. But Joseph Campbell, writing about heroes, said, if you realize what the problem is, losing yourself, giving yourself to some higher end or to another, you realize that this itself is the ultimate trial. When we quit thinking primarily about ourselves and our own self-preservation, we undergo a truly heroic transformation of consciousness. I ran into this story last year that I really liked, and when I taught it, I liked it even more. I thought, well, this will be neat. But once I taught it, I can't believe it. It's even better than I thought. It's a story by Stephen Crane called The Mystery of Heroism. And it's a Civil War story, short story, about this braggart who's boasting about all these things he can do, and they're in battle, and he's bragging to his friends about how he's going to run out into the battlefield and get some water because there's a well down there, and he's sort of thirsty. He's not dying of thirst, he's just sort of thirsty. And so his friends start grabbing him and pushing him, saying, well, go do it. I will. Well, go do it. Well, don't push me. I will. And ultimately, to save face, he has to go do it. He's no hero in any shape or fashion. And he runs out, and he gets some water, and he's running back. And as he's running back, a dying man on the battlefield looks at him and asks for water. And he sort of chuckles and runs past. And then he comes back, and he gives the guy water, and he leaves. And he gets back, and the water falls, and that's it. And the water spills, and nobody even drinks it. Heroism. The mystery of heroism. And I think Crane's trying to say that when he went back, even though the bullets were whizzing, even though it was stupid, and he knew it was stupid, he had to do it because it was the right thing to do. We're not called upon to be great heroes, but our actions matter, and the things we do matter. An Emory professor wrote about Holocaust resistors, people who fought to protect, to hide, to shield, and to allow the escape of Jews and others facing Nazi genocide. And he said, or she said, that they were very, very different people, different economic backgrounds, different educations, different sexes, races. There was no similar bond they shared except one. None of them, or at least most of them, didn't think they were doing anything heroic. They were simply doing what was right. I mean, they had to do it. I mean, I wasn't doing anything wrong. I mean, I had to do that. There was nothing special about it. Well, sometimes they're just things that are right. And when you're working with a student, and you're sharing ideas, and you're helping them learn, you know you're doing the right thing. And it doesn't matter. You just know. You know. Joseph Campbell also wrote, that you need to find work that you enjoy. He said, the influence of a vital person vitalizes. There's no doubt about it. The world without spirit is a wasteland. People have the notion of saving the world by shifting things around, changing the rules and who's on top and so forth. No. Any world is a valid world if it's alive. The thing to do is bring life to it. Become alive yourself. Well, I think you'll seldom feel more alive than you feel in a time like this, at a workshop like this. It's a very intense and rewarding time. Notice it, think about it, evaluate it, grow with it. Stanley Hauerwas said, insights are a dime a dozen and useless unless we have the skills, the images, and the stories which can empower those insights to shape our lives. Well, there's something special there. Don't miss your opportunity. Dan Quayle, when he was vice president, said, I was recently on a tour of Latin America, and the only regret I have was that I didn't study Latin harder in school. Now, he wants to be president. I can only imagine the Quayle's advantage that would come if we had hold of that. In my classes each year, at least the class I teach predominantly, I show two films over the course of the year. And one of those films is called The Mission. In that film, a priest leads to the death of many, many, many innocent people. And toward the end of the film, he realizes what he's done, and someone tries to console him and says, you could not help it, Your Eminence. We must work in the world. The world is thus. He looks back and says, no, Senor Hantar, thus have we made the world. thus have I made it. It's the most powerful film I've ever seen. It sort of demands that you think. So does the sign on Tuna's office. There's a sign on the door to his office. It's a quotation by Margaret Mead. And it says, "Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has." Real students are here to be taught. Coaches, go wrap yourself up in sheets like Socrates and take your students out to teach them. Now, that's not to say that all Greeks wear sheets or that there's anything wrong with wearing a sheet. But we have individuals that we can help, individuals we can teach. I don't know if we can change the world. I know we can help it. And even more than that, I know we can help individuals. And that's enough for me. James Agee said, "In every child who is born, under no matter what circumstances, and of no matter what parents, the potentiality of the human race is born again." I believe that. And I also agree with an idea expressed by Deborah Lipstadt, an Emory professor of modern Jewish and Holocaust studies. She said more than 1,500 years ago, the rabbis taught that a person who saves one life, it is as if they saved the entire world. Let's get going. There's a lot of work to do. Thank you very much.
Two really quick things. This is one of the few times that we'll have the high school and the college students really together. And I just want you to look at each other and see yourselves, if that's really who you are. Let's have the college students give a round of applause in the high school debaters. We have the experienced high school debaters in here, and a lot of you can do a lot of good helping the inexperienced high school students who are here. And I want to urge you to help them get something out of debate like you have. Help them in the dormitories, help them with their questions. If they're arrogant, let them know it. If they're downtrodden, lift them up. If they need advice, give it. If they have advice, take it. But let's all help each other, especially in the dormitories. If things go bad in the dormitories, I'm going to have to clamp down on the dorm rules, and it's going to affect the experienced high school students as well as the inexperienced high school students. So please help me. Thanks very much for your attention. Have a great evening. Go right away! Go right away!